I want you to just take a second and think about what is happening to you right this exact moment.
Oh, that's always a fun exercise.
Right. Because you're listening to my voice, obviously. But maybe you're also feeling, you know, the pressure of the chair against your back.
Or the subtle vibration of the steering wheel in your hands if you're driving.
Exactly. Or maybe there's a distant siren outside, or a faint flicker of hunger in your stomach, or even just a half-formed thought about an email you forgot to send.
Yeah, the mental to-do list.
The endless list. And the thing is, you are constantly, relentlessly drowning in noise. We all are.
It is an absolute nonstop flood. I mean, you have internal signals, external stimuli, emotional weights, and raw physical sensations bombarding the central nervous system every single millisecond.
Which is wild to think about.
It really is. The sheer volume of data should, theoretically, completely paralyze us.
But it doesn't. Somehow, continuously and mostly completely beneath our conscious awareness, something in your brain parses that entire flood. It decides what actually matters right now, and then violently shifts your entire reality to focus on that one thing.
It's an incredible sorting mechanism.
It really is. And to understand how your brain filters all that noise and makes those split-second judgments, we're diving into a really fascinating 2026 paper from the OOTW Journal.
Yes, the one called The Switch.
Yeah, Switch, the Salience Network, and What Matters.
It's a great piece of research.
It's so good. So our mission today for this deep dive is to uncover this hidden ancient mechanism that controls our attention. We want to understand, you know, why we get stuck in mental ruts and explore the cutting-edge neuroscience of how we might actually reset a locked mind.
Which is going to take us on a journey from the fundamental anatomical architecture of how we think all the way to some of the most profound questions about mental health, consciousness, and healing.
Okay, let's unpack this, because the core mystery here is almost too relatable.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, who exactly works the light switch in our minds?
Right. And to understand the switch itself, we first have to look at the rooms it actually controls.
Okay, the rooms.
Yeah. So for a long time, the dominant model in neuroscience was that the brain essentially operates between two massive competing systems.
Okay.
The first one is the default mode network. You can basically conceptualize this as the inward-facing brain.
Inward-facing meaning like my internal monologue.
Exactly. It's the neurological infrastructure that is humming along when you are lost in thought. You know, remembering the past, imagining the future, or reflecting on your own identity.
So it's the classic daydreaming in the shower mode.
Yes, exactly. It's the self-referential network. Now, the opposing system to that is the central executive network.
And this would be the outward-facing brain then.
You got it. It engages heavily when you are directing your focus toward a demanding external task.
Okay, like what?
Like if you are doing complex mental math or navigating heavy traffic in a sudden downpour or piecing together a really difficult spreadsheet at work, your executive network is running the show in those moments.
And the crucial detail about these two networks is that they are anti-correlated.
Yes, highly anti-correlated.
It means, well, if you look at functional MRI scans, when blood flow and metabolic activity increase in the executive network, that activity actively decreases in the default mode.
Right. They do not share power.
They're a seesaw.
Exactly. You biologically cannot be intensely focused on catching a fast-moving baseball while simultaneously having a deep, abstract reverie about your childhood.
That would end terribly for the baseball player.
It would end very badly, yes.
Yeah.
The brain has to toggle between the outward demand and the inward reflection.
Yay.
But for years, this tidy binary story of the two networks left a massive gaping hole in our understanding of cognitive dynamics.
Because something has to be doing the toggling.
Precisely. If the inward brain and the outward brain are constantly handing power back and forth, who or what is actually coordinating the handoff?
Which brings us to the 2007 Stanford discovery.
Yes, William Seeley and Vinod Menon.
Right. Researchers Seeley and Menon were doing these advanced mappings of the brain's intrinsic connectivity, and they isolated a third major system that simply didn't fit into the default mode or the executive buckets.
And they called it the Salience Network.
The Salience Network. Okay, so where is it?
It is structurally anchored in two very specific deep-seated regions of the brain. The first is the anterior insula.
The insula.
Yeah, which is a piece of the cortex folded deep within the lateral sulcus. So it's essentially hidden beneath the outer surface of the brain.
Wow, okay.
And the second hub is the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex, or the DACC, which sits right on the midline.
It's so deep inside.
Very deep. And what Seeley, Menon, and subsequent researchers discovered was that this third network is wired directly into the visceral emotional machinery of the body.
So it's tied to our physical feelings.
Exactly. Its primary function is to constantly scan the horizon, both the external world and your internal physical state, and pick out which stimuli are the most behaviorally relevant in that exact millisecond.
It detects what is salient.
Hence the name, Salience Network.
Right. But spotting the important thing is only half the battle, right? I mean, to actually change our behavior, it has to do something with that information.
And that's where the 2008 research comes in.
Yeah. A researcher named Devarajan Sridharan and his team, they managed to track the exact temporal flow of these signals.
Sridharan's work was really the watershed moment here. They used advanced chronometry techniques with fMRI data to look at directional signaling.
Which basically means...
essentially trying to figure out which brain region fires first when a person shifts their attention.
The chicken or the egg.
Right. And they found that the activation in the right anterior insula, that core hub of the salience network we just mentioned, doesn't just react to the shift in attention.
Wait, it doesn't?
No, it precedes it. It predicts it.
Wow. So the insula is actually throwing the lever.
Yes.
So if we think about the brain like a nightclub, just to use an analogy here, the default mode network is the VIP lounge, where you're just hanging out in your own head, deep in conversation with yourself.
I like this, yeah.
And the executive network is the dance floor, where you're out there actively performing and engaging with the environment.
Right.
So the salience network is the bouncer who suddenly grabs you by the collar and says, hey, your name was just called, get out there.
That perfectly captures the mechanism. I mean, it explains the everyday aha moment we all experience.
That cocktail party effect.
Exactly. Imagine you are at a loud, crowded party. You've completely zoned out, staring at the wall, fully submerged in your default mode network.
Just totally in your own head.
Right. And suddenly, from 30 feet away, someone murmurs your first name.
You snap out of the daydream instantly.
At a fraction of a second.
It's so fast.
It is. Mm. The salience network was passively monitoring that overwhelming wall of auditory noise. It caught the specific acoustic signature of your name, flagged it as highly relevant to your social standing or survival, and violently yanked you out of the VIP lounge.
So the bouncer threw me onto the dance floor.
Basically, yes. It sent a rapid cascade of inhibitory signals to dial down the default mode and excitatory signals to dial up the executive network, allowing you to quickly scan the room and figure out who is talking about you.
Okay, I want to drill down into the sheer speed of this because the physical hardware making this happen is wild.
It's incredible biology.
Yeah, how can one network make these massive brain-wide reallocations of our attention so fast? The architecture here relies on a highly specialized type of cell called the von Economo neuron.
Also known as spindle neurons.
Spindle neurons.
And they are structurally distinct from the typical pyramidal neurons that make up most of our cortex.
Because typical neurons are heavily branched, right? Like complex trees.
Exactly. Lots of little branches connecting to nearby cells.
But these von Economo neurons are huge, elongated, cigar-shaped cells.
Yes. Very long and thick.
And they sit in a very specific layer of the cortex layer, VEB, I think. And they have these massive, thick axons that allow them to bypass local processing and shoot high-speed signals across vast distances in the brain.
They are essentially the fiber optic cables of the brain.
But the most stunning detail from the source material isn't just their shape or their speed. It's where you find them in the animal kingdom.
Oh, this is my favorite part.
They are almost exclusively found in humans, great apes, elephants, and cetaceans like whales and dolphins.
Which provides such a profound evolutionary context.
It really does.
Because if you look at the common denominators among those species, they all possess exceptionally large brains.
Yeah.
And they all navigate incredibly complex hierarchical social structures.
So having this elite high-speed hardware, this rapid-fire attention switch, evolved directly alongside highly social, highly intelligent survival.
Precisely. You need an incredibly fast bouncer if you have a massive brain and complex social threats to navigate.
Right, because reading a room can be life or death for a social primate.
Exactly. And this brings us to a fundamental biological reality about where this switch lives.
Okay.
We have to ask why this high-speed network is physically anchored in the anterior insula in the first place.
Right. Why there?
Well, the insula is not an abstract processing center. It is the primary cortical seat of interoception.
Interoception. That means monitoring the internal state of your body, right?
Yes. It is constantly receiving data from your organs.
Like the felt thump of a heartbeat or the sudden drop in your gut or the flush of heat in your skin.
Exactly. That visceral data stream. evolutionarily speaking, what defines whether something is salient or important?
I guess if it can kill you.
Right. It's whatever alters your bodily homeostasis or threatens your survival. Because the insula sits directly on top of this stream of raw interoceptive signals, it is perfectly positioned to feel the bodily stakes of any situation.
Wow. Okay.
Using a physiological change, like your heart rate spiking, as the metric to decide what deserves the mind's limited spotlight.
Hold on. I'm trying to wrap my head around the implications of this. Are you saying my conscious, rational focus is entirely at the mercy of my biology?
Yes and no, but mostly yes.
Let's say I'm trying to focus on a deeply boring spreadsheet for work, relying heavily on my top-down executive network.
Okay, the dance floor.
Right. But I drank 3 cups of coffee, my heart rate elevates, and my gut tightens.
A very common office scenario.
Yeah. Does my salience network read that physical gut tightening as a threat and automatically hijack my attention away from the spreadsheet? Am I just a hostage to my internal organs?
What's fascinating here is the interplay between top-down intention and bottom-up biology.
Okay.
Yes. Beneath your conscious will, this ancient system is judging survival based on somatic markers. You can exert top-down executive control to focus on the spreadsheet, sure.
Right, willpower.
But if your salience network registers a strong enough interoceptive signal, a sudden sharp pain, extreme nausea, or the physical symptoms of a panic attack, it will absolutely force the switch.
It just overrides me.
The bottom-up survival signal overrides your conscious intent, shifting your attention inward to deal with the perceived physical crisis.
So what does this all mean? If this highly specialized, evolutionarily ancient switch is effectively running our reality, what happens when it mechanically jams?
That is the million-dollar question in psychiatry right now.
Because relying on a single network to toggle our entire consciousness seems like a massive vulnerability.
It is a single point of failure that explains a tremendous amount of human suffering.
Yeah.
The transition we are seeing in modern neuroscience is the application of this triple network model to major psychiatric disorders.
Moving away from just chemical imbalances.
Exactly. Instead of viewing these conditions purely as chemical imbalances, researchers are increasingly framing them as network dynamics problems.
It's a structural issue.
Right. If the switch gets physically stuck, or if the von Economo neurons miscalibrate their threat assessments, your entire subjective reality warps.
Let's break down the mechanics of a few of these conditions, starting with depression and rumination. The source details how this is essentially a failure to disengage the inward-facing brain.
Yes. In severe depressive rumination, the default mode network becomes hyperconnected and overactive.
So they get trapped in the VIP lounge.
Exactly. The person gets trapped, cycling endlessly through painful, self-referential thoughts, regrets, self-criticisms, bleak internal narratives.
And the bouncer won't let them out.
The mechanical failure is that the salience network struggles to toggle the switch. It cannot efficiently pull the brain out of the default mode and hand control over to the outward-facing executive network.
The door is effectively jammed.
Jammed shut, denying the person the relief of being absorbed in an external task.
Wow. And anxiety presents as almost the inverse mechanical problem, right? The salience network isn't jammed closed, it's hyperreactive.
Yes, the threshold for what constitutes a threat drops dramatically.
And everything is a threat.
Early studies, including Seeley's 2007 work, found that a person's baseline anxiety levels correlated directly with the resting state connectivity of their salience network.
So it's always kind of buzzing.
The network is essentially blasting a blaring alarm, screaming, "This matters! Pay attention to this danger!" At entirely neutral stimuli.
Like an innocuous email from your boss.
Or a minor change in someone's tone of voice, or even a slight flutter in their own chest.
Then you have addiction, where the switch is violently hijacked by very specific learned cues.
It learns the wrong lesson about what's important for survival.
The network has been conditioned to believe that a specific substance, or even just the environmental cue of seeing a lighter or a specific street corner, is the single most salient thing for the organism's survival.
And that cue triggers the von Economo neurons to fire so intensely that it drowns out all competing executive priorities.
Like going to work or maintaining relationship.
Exactly. The bouncer throws you toward the substance, ignoring everything else.
But perhaps the most profound demonstration of the switch's power is in psychosis, specifically this phenomenon known as aberrant salience.
Aberrant salience, yes.
This was a completely new concept to me, and the mechanics of it are deeply unsettling. Walk us through exactly what aberrant salience looks like in the brain.
To understand it, you have to look at the neurotransmitter dopamine.
Okay, dopamine.
Dopamine acts as the chemical messenger within the salience network to flag something as important. In a healthy system, a dopamine spike tells the brain, pay attention to this, it matters.
Right.
But in a psychotic episode, this system misfires. The salience network begins flooding the brain with massive dopamine spikes randomly.
Just completely unprompted.
Completely disconnected from what is actually happening in the environment.
So imagine you are just walking down a completely normal street, minding your own business, and a red Toyota drives by.
Normally, your brain filters that out as irrelevant background noise.
Right.
But if your salience network randomly fires a massive dopamine surge at the exact moment you look at the red Toyota, your conscious brain is suddenly handed a terrifying problem.
Because your body is reacting.
Your body and your deepest neurological alarm systems are screaming, this is of life or death importance.
But your eyes are just looking at a mundane car.
Exactly.
And the executive network has to resolve that contradiction.
Precisely. The conscious mind cannot tolerate the cognitive dissonance of feeling profound significance without a cause.
So it makes one up.
It builds a bridge to explain the physical feeling. It invents a narrative.
Like, that red car is following me.
The people inside know my thoughts. Or, it is a government conspiracy.
Oh my God.
The delusion isn't the primary symptom. The delusion is just the higher order brain desperately trying to make sense of a broken hardware switch, constantly sounding the maximum alarm.
Hearing it explained that way fundamentally changes how you view mental illness.
It really does.
It completely strips away the moral judgment and the shame. I mean, if someone is suffering from severe depression or a psychotic break, you can't just tell them to snap out of it or focus on the positive.
No, you can't.
You cannot use sheer executive willpower to override a cluster of massive spindle neurons in your insula that are mechanically locked in the wrong position. It is a structural network failure.
It forces us to view psychological suffering through the lens of impaired network dynamics. You are trapped in a terrifying room, not because you lack willpower, but because the biological door is jammed.
So if the root of so much suffering is this rigid, stuck switch, how is modern neuroscience attempting to unjam the door?
Well, this is where it gets really interesting.
Right. Because this leads us to the final part of our mission today and some of the most fascinating frontier research covered in the source. The attempt to essentially melt the switch down so the brain can reorganize itself.
Which brings us to the complex and heavily studied intersection of the salience network and psychedelic compounds.
Okay, let's get into this. Because classic psychedelics compounds like LSD, psilocybin, and DMT, they all share a primary mechanism of action.
They do.
They act on a very specific receptor in the brain called the serotonin 2A receptor. And the geographical distribution of these receptors is the key here.
Yes, location is everything.
They are densely packed into the deep cortical layers of the very high-level hubs we've been discussing, particularly the default mode and the salience networks.
When a classic psychedelic agonizes or activates these serotonin 2A receptors, it heavily excites the deep pyramidal cells in those brain regions.
Okay, so they get hyperstimulated.
Now, normally, as we've established, these networks maintain their crisp boundaries and anti-correlated relationships through highly synchronized rhythmic firing patterns.
The bouncer keeping the room separate.
Right. But when those 2A receptors are intensely stimulated, that synchronized rhythm breaks down. The rigid electrical walls holding the networks apart begin to degrade.
There was a landmark imaging study in 2016 led by Enzo Tagliazzucchi and Robin Carhart-Harris that visualized this exact breakdown.
A truly groundbreaking study.
They put subjects under the influence of LSD into fMRI scanners to watch the networks in real time. What did they see?
The scans revealed a massive, dramatic increase in what neuroscientists call global functional connectivity.
Meaning everything is talking to everything.
Yes. The strict separation between the networks dissolved. The default mode network, the executive network, the visual cortex regions of the brain that rarely communicate directly, suddenly started talking to each other all at once.
It's just a free-for-all.
The brain's overall entropy, or disorder, skyrocketed.
And the degree to which those boundaries collapsed in the scanner correlated directly with the subject's reported subjective experience of ego dissolution.
Yes, ego dissolution.
Which is the feeling that the boundary between the self and the external universe has completely vanished.
Right. Because if the default mode network generates our sense of internal self, and the executive network processes the external world.
And the salience network acts as the bouncer, keeping those two domains strictly separated.
Psychedelics temporarily incapacitate the bouncer. The doors between the self and the world are thrown wide open.
Here's where it gets really interesting as a therapeutic concept.
Yeah.
Imagine the brain is a steep, snowy hill.
I love this analogy, Gad.
Through years of chronic depression, anxiety, or addiction, your thoughts are like sleds that have gone down the exact same path hundreds of times a day.
Carving a deeper rut every time.
Exactly. They have carved these deep, rigid, icy grooves into the hill. And no matter how hard you try to steer with your conscious will, the sled just gets caught in the groove and takes you down the same painful path.
Right, because the salience network is stuck.
But the psychedelic experience briefly acts like a heavy, fresh snowfall. It drastically increases brain plasticity and fills in all those deep, rigid grooves.
It creates a smooth surface so you can finally steer a new path.
It lets the stuck switch temporarily reset.
That is the core therapeutic hypothesis driving the current renaissance in psychedelic medicine.
It's incredible.
By temporarily dismantling the rigid, overtrained networks responsible for compulsive threat tagging or rumination, the brain is afforded a window of plasticity to lay down new, healthier pathways.
A fresh start, basically.
However, this raises an important question, and we must rigorously examine the honest cautions presented in the source material.
Yes, because the brain is rarely as simple as our neatest metaphors.
Exactly. First, while the triple network model is an incredibly elegant and useful framework, it is ultimately a simplification.
The brain is messy.
Very messy. The anterior insula is not just a toggle switch. It is a deeply complex hub involved in processing physical pain, emotional empathy, disgust, and even our perception of time.
So if you mess with it, you're messing with a lot of things.
When we assign one tidy job to a piece of anatomy, we risk oversimplifying a massively distributed, highly integrated system.
We can't treat the brain like a simple machine with cleanly separated mechanical parts.
Furthermore, while the fMRI data showing massive global connectivity under psychedelics is highly robust and easily replicated, the specific narrative that this connectivity heals trauma by resetting the salience network remains an actively studied hypothesis.
It's not a settled fact yet.
It is a compelling theory, but it is not a settled, infallible medical fact. The leap from observing altered blood flow in a scanner to claiming a universal cure for human trauma requires years of rigorous clinical trials, many of which are still ongoing.
And the source material is explicitly clear about the risks, which makes total sense given our deep dive into aberrant salience a moment ago.
The risks are very real.
Psychedelics act powerfully and unpredictably on the salience network. They are not universally safe. For individuals who have a personal or family history of psychotic disorders, schizophrenia, or severe bipolar disorder, forcefully dissolving the walls of the salience network carries severe risks.
Because of what we discussed with dopamine and aberrant salience?
Right. If a person's neurological architecture is already prone to assigning massive, unwarranted significance to random stimuli, flooding that system with profoundly destabilizing compound could trigger or worsen psychosis.
The source maintains a meticulous neutrality on this front. It presents the staggering potential for profound, rapid healing right alongside the reality of profound risk.
Which is the responsible way to look at it.
It treats psychedelics as a powerful, uncalibrated tool on the frontier of neuroscience, not as a magical panacea.
But even with all the unknowns, just understanding that this mechanism exists inside our heads changes everything.
It changes the entire paradigm.
Realizing that our entire reality is constantly being filtered, judged, and routed through this tiny biological gateway completely shifts how you view your own mind.
If we synthesize the underlying truth connecting all these studies from von Economo neurons to network chronometry, it is this. Our conscious freedom of attention is, to a large extent, an illusion.
It's a tough pill to swallow.
We fiercely protect the belief that we are the rational captains of our own focus. But just beneath the floorboards of our awareness, there is an ancient, lightning-fast network judging a chaotic flood of bodily signals to determine what is real and what matters.
The bouncer in the dark.
When it operates flawlessly, we seamlessly engage with the world and retreat into ourselves. When the hardware breaks, our reality fractures.
Which leaves me with a thought I haven't been able to shake, and I want to leave the listener with this puzzle to mull over.
Go for it.
We've just spent the last 20 minutes learning that our most profound sense of what is meaningful, urgent, or beautiful in life is ultimately driven by a mechanical toggling of spindle neurons reacting to subtle shifts in our heart rate and our gut.
Right.
If our entire subjective reality is dictated by an automatic interoceptive bouncer, does true conscious free will even exist?
It forces us to question who is actually driving the car.
And take it one step further into the future. If neuroscience eventually mapped this system perfectly and gave you a manual remote control to your own salience network.
Oh, wow.
Like a way to consciously override your insula with the push of a button, what would you do with it?
That is quite the thought experiment.
Would you ever let yourself feel an uncomfortable, painful truth or an urgent, terrifying anxiety ever again? Or would you just permanently toggle yourself into the VIP lounge, locked in a state of blissful inward calm, ignoring the burning world entirely?
That is the ultimate ethical dilemma of finally possessing the keys to your own mind.
Something to think about the next time you hear your name called from across a crowded room and your brain decides to pull you onto the dance floor. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive.
Thanks for listening.